poor widow who has been robbed comes along and I give her 50 rupees, to another 100, and so on and so on. I should like that. Mrs. Moore smiled, thinking of the modern method as exemplified in her son.
Rupees don't last forever, I'm afraid.
Mine would. God would give me more when he saw I gave. Always be giving, like the Nawab Bahadur. My father was the same, that is why he died poor. And pointing about the room, he peopled it with clerks and officials, all benevolent because they lived long ago. So we would sit giving forever, on a carpet instead of chairs. That is the chief change between now and then. But I think we would never punish anyone. The ladies agreed. Poor criminal, give him another chance. It only makes a man worse to go to prison and be corrupted. His face grew very tender, the tenderness of one incapable of administration, and unable to grasp that if the poor criminal is let off, he will again rob the poor widow. He was tender to everyone except a few family enemies whom he did not consider human. On these, he desired revenge. He was even tender to the English. He knew at the bottom of his heart that they could not help being so cold and odd and circulating like an ice stream through his land. "We punish no one, no one," he repeated. "And in the evening we will give a great banquet with a notch, and lovely girls shall shine on every side of the tank with fireworks in their hands, and all shall be feasting and happiness until the next day, when there shall be justice as before, 50 rupees, 100, 1,000, till peace comes." Ah, why didn't we live in that time?
But are you admiring Mr. Fielding's house? Do look how the pillars are painted blue, and the verandas, pavilions, what you call them, that are above us inside, are blue also. Look at the carving on the pavilions. Think of the hours it took. Their little roofs are curved to imitate bamboo, so pretty. And the bamboos waving by the tank outside. Mrs. Moore, Mrs. Moore.
Well, she said, laughing, you remember the water by our mosque? It comes down and fills this tank, a skillful arrangement of the emperor's. They stopped here, going down into Bengal. They loved water. Wherever they went, they created fountains, gardens, hammams. I was telling Mr. Fielding I would give anything to serve them.
He was wrong about the water, which no emperor, however skillful, can cause to gravitate uphill. A depression of some depth, together with the whole of Chandrapur, lay between the mosque and Fielding's house. Ronnie would have pulled him up. Turton would have wanted to pull him up, but restrained himself. Fielding did not even want to pull him up. He had dulled his craving for verbal truth, and cared chiefly for truth of mood. As for Miss Quested, she accepted everything Aziz said as true verbally. In her ignorance, she regarded him as India, and never surmised that his outlook was limited and his method inaccurate, and that no one is India. Less than the dust, the schoolboy murmured the word,
diarrhea,
but took courage as soon as it had been uttered, for it improved his position. Flames of suspicion shot up again in the breasts of his elders, though in different direction. Could what was called diarrhea really be an early case of cholera?
If this is so, this is a very serious thing. This is scarcely the end of March. Why have I not been informed? Cried Aziz.
Dr. Panna Lal attends him, sir.
Oh, yes, both Hindus. There we have it. They hang together like flies and keep everything dark. Rafi, come here, sit down. Tell me all the details. Is there vomiting also?
Oh, yes, indeed, sir, and the serious pains.
That settles it. In 24 hours he will be dead.
Everybody looked and felt shocked, but Professor Godbole had diminished his appeal by linking himself with a co-religionist. He moved them less than when he had appeared as a suffering individual. Before long they began to condemn him as a source of infection.
All illness proceeds from Hindus, Mr. Huck said.
Mr. Syed Mohammed had visited religious fairs at Allahabad and at Ujjain and described them with biting scorn. At Allahabad there was flowing water which carried impurities away, but at Ujjain the little river Sipra was banked up
and thousands of bathers deposited their germs in the pool. He spoke with disgust of the hot sun, the cow dung and marigold flowers, and the encampment of sadhus, some of whom strode stark naked through the streets. Asked what was the name of the chief idol at Ujjain, he replied that he did not know. He had disdained to inquire. He really could not waste his time over such trivialities. His outburst took some time, and in his excitement he fell into Punjabi, he came from that side, and was unintelligible. Aziz liked to hear his religion praised. It soothed the surface of his mind and allowed beautiful images to form beneath. When the engineer's noisy tirade was finished, he said, "That is exactly my own view." He held up his hand, palm outward. His eyes began to glow, his heart to fill with tenderness. Issuing still further from his quilt, he recited a poem by Ghalib. It had no connection with anything that had gone before, but it came from his heart and spoke to theirs. They were overwhelmed by its pathos. Pathos, they agreed, is the highest quality in art. A poem should touch the hearer with a sense of his own weakness and should institute some comparison between mankind and flowers. The squalid bedroom grew quiet. The silly intrigues, the gossip, the shallow discontent were stilled, while words accepted as immortal filled the indifferent air. Not as a call to battle, but as a calm assurance came the feeling that India was won. Muslim. Always had been, an assurance that lasted until they looked out of the door. Whatever Ghalib had felt, he had anyhow lived in India, and thus consolidated it for them. He had gone with his own tulips and roses, but tulips and roses do not go. And the sister kingdoms of the north, Arabia, Persia, Fergana, Turkestan, stretched out their hands as he sang, sadly, because all beauty is sad, and greeted ridiculous Chandrapur, where every street and house was divided against itself, and told her that she was a continent and a unity. India knows of their trouble. She knows of the whole world's trouble to its uttermost depth. She calls, "Come," through her hundred mouths, through objects ridiculous and august. But come to what? She has never defined. She is not a promise, only an appeal.
"I will fetch you from Simla when it's cool enough. I will unbottle you, in fact," continued the reliable girl. "We then see some of the Mughal stuff. How appalling if we let you miss the Taj. And then I will see you off at Bombay. Your last glimpse of this country really shall be interesting."
But Mrs. Moore had fallen asleep, exhausted by the early start. She was in rather low health and ought not to have attempted the expedition, but had pulled herself together in case the pleasure of the other should suffer. Her dreams were of the same texture, but there it was her other children who were wanting something, Stella and Ralph, and she was explaining to them that she could not be in two families at once. When she awoke, Adela had ceased to plan and leant out of a window, saying,
"They're rather wonderful."
Astonishing even from the rise of the civil station, here the Marabar were gods to whom earth is a ghost. Kawa Dol was nearest. It shot up in a single slab, on whose summit one rock was poised, if a mass so great could be called one rock. Behind it, recumbent, were the hills that contained the other caves, isolated each from his neighbour by broad channels of the plain. The assemblage, 10 in all, shifted a little as the train crept past them, as if observing its arrival.
"I'd not have missed this for anything," said the girl,
exaggerating her enthusiasm.
"Look, the sun's rising. This'll be absolutely magnificent. Come quickly, look. I wouldn't have missed this for anything. We should never have seen it if we'd stuck to the Turtons and their eternal elephants."
As she spoke, the sky to the left turned angry orange. Colour throbbed and mounted behind a pattern of trees, grew in intensity, was yet brighter, incredibly brighter, strained from without against the globe of the air. They awaited the miracle. But at the supreme moment, when night should have died and day lived, nothing occurred. It was as if virtue had failed in the celestial fount. The hues in the east decayed, the hills seemed dimmer, though in fact better lit, and a profound disappointment entered with the morning breeze. Why, when the chamber was prepared, did the bridegroom not enter with trumpets and shawms, as humanity expects? The sun rose without splendor. He was presently observed trailing yellowish behind the trees or against insipid sky, and touching the bodies already at work in the fields.
Ah, that must be the false dawn. Isn't it caused by dust in the upper layers of the atmosphere that couldn't fall down during the night? I think Mr. McBride said so. Well, I must admit that England has it as regards sunrises. Do you remember Grasmere?
Ah, dearest Grasmere.
Its little lakes and mountains were beloved by them all. Romantic, yet manageable, it sprang from a kindlier planet. Here, an untidy plain stretched to the knees of the Marabar.
Good morning, good morning. Put on your topis, shouted
Aziz from further down the train.
Put on your topis at once. The early sun is highly dangerous for heads. I speak as a doctor.
Good morning, good morning. Put on your own.
Not for my thick head,
he laughed, banging it and holding up pads of his hair.
Nice creature he is, murmured Adela.
Listen, Mohammed Latif says good morning next.
Various pointless jests.
Dr. Aziz, what's happened to your hills? The train has forgotten to stop.
Perhaps it is a circular train and goes back to Chandrapur without a break. Who knows?
I wouldn't keep you waiting. Good heavens, you take precedence of any Indian visitor, of course. I meant, what's the good? Why mix yourself up with pitch?
I say he's innocent.
Innocence or guilt, why mix yourself up? What's the good?
Oh, good, good, he cried, feeling that every earth was being stopped. One's got to breathe occasionally, at least I have. I mayn't see her, and now I mayn't see him. I promised him to come up here with him to you, but Turton called me off before I could get two steps.
Sort of all-white thing our collector would do, he muttered sentimentally.
And trying not to sound patronizing, he stretched his hand over the table and said,
We shall all have to hang together, old man, I'm afraid. I'm your junior in years, I know, but very much your senior in service. You don't happen to know this poisonous country as well as I do, and you must take it from me that the general situation is going to be nasty at Chandrapur during the next few weeks, very nasty indeed. So I have just told you. But at a time like this, there's no room for, well, personal views. The man who doesn't toe the line is lost. I see what you mean. No, you don't see entirely. He not only loses himself, he weakens his friends. If you leave the line, you leave a gap in the line. And these jackals,
he pointed at the lawyer's cards,
are looking with all their eyes for a gap.
Can I visit Aziz? Was his answer.
No.
Now that he knew of Turton's attitude, the policeman had no doubts.
You may see him on a magistrate's order, but on my own responsibility I don't feel justified. It might lead to more complications.
He paused, reflecting that if he had been either 10 years younger or 10 years longer in India, he would have responded to McBride's appeal. The bit between his teeth, he then said,
To whom do I apply for an order?
City magistrate. Now that sounds comfortable. Yes. One can't very well worry poor Heslop.
More evidence appeared at this moment. The table drawer from Aziz's bungalow, borne with triumph in a corporal's arms.
Photographs of women, ah. That's his wife,
said Fielding, wincing.
How do you know that?
He told me.
McBride gave a faint, incredulous smile and started rummaging in the drawer. His face became inquisitive and slightly bestial.
Wife, indeed, I know those wives, he was thinking.
Aloud, he said,
Well, you must trot off now, old man, and the Lord help us. The Lord help us all.
As if his prayer had been heard, there was a sudden rackety-dacket on a temple bell. Her constant thought was, less attention should be paid to my future daughter-in-law, and more to me. There is no sorrow like my sorrow. Although when the attention was paid, she rejected it irritably. Her son couldn't escort her to Bombay, for the local situation continued acute, and all officials had to remain at their posts. Anthony couldn't come either, in case he never returned to give his evidence. So she travelled with no one who could remind her of the past. This was a relief. The heat had drawn back a little before its next advance, and the journey was not unpleasant. As she left Chandrapur, the moon, full again, shone over the Ganges and touched the shrinking channels into threads of silver, then veered and looked into her window. The swift and comfortable mail train slid with her through the night, and all the next day she was rushing through central India, through landscapes that were baked and bleached, but had not the hopeless melancholy of the plain. She watched the indestructible life of man and his changing faces, and the houses he has built for himself and God, and they appeared to her not in terms of her own trouble, but as things to see. There was, for instance, a place called Asirga, which she passed at sunset and identified on a map, an enormous fortress among wooded hills. No one had ever mentioned Asirga to her, but it had huge and noble bastions, and to the right of them was a mosque. She forgot it. 10 minutes later, Asirga reappeared. The mosque was to the left of the bastions now. The train, in its descent through the Vindhyas, had described a semicircle round Asirga. What could she connect it with, except its own name? Nothing. She knew no one who lived there. But it looked at her twice and seemed to say, I do not vanish. She woke in the middle of the night with a start, for the train was falling over the western cliff. Moonlit pinnacles rushed up at her like the fringes of a sea. Then, a brief episode of pain, the real sea, and the soupy dawn of Bombay.
I have not seen the right places, she thought.
As she saw embayed in the platforms of the Victoria Terminus the end of the rails that had carried her over a continent and could never carry her back. She would never visit Asirga or the other untouched places, neither Delhi nor Agra, nor the Rajputana cities, nor Kashmir, nor the obscurer marvels that had sometimes shone through men's speech, the bilingual rock of Girna, the statue of Sri Balgola, the ruins of Mandu and Hampi, temples of Khajuraho, gardens of Shalimar. As she drove through the huge city which the West has built, and abandoned with a gesture of despair, she longed to stop, though it was only Bombay, and disentangle the 100 Indias that passed each other in its streets. The feet of the horses moved her on, and presently the boat sailed, and thousands of coconut palms appeared all round the anchorage and climbed the hills to wave her farewell. So you thought an echo was India. You took the Malabar Caves as final, they laughed. What have we in common with them, or they with Asirga? Goodbye. Then the steamer rounded Colaba, the continent swung about, the cliff of the Ghats melted into the haze of a tropic sea. Lady Mellenby turned up and advised her not to stand in the heat.
We are safely out of the frying pan, said Lady Mellenby. It will never do to fall into the fire.
How indeed is it possible for one human being to be sorry for all the sadness that meets him on the face of the earth, for the pain that is endured not only by men, but by animals and plants, and perhaps by the stones. The soul is tired in a moment, and in fear of losing the little she does understand, she retreats to the permanent lines which habit or chance have dictated, and suffers there. Fielding had met the dead woman only 2 or 3 times, Hamidullah had seen her in the distance once, and they were far more occupied with the coming gathering at Dilkusha, the victory dinner, for which they would be most victoriously late. They agreed not to tell Aziz about Mrs. Moore till the morrow, because he was fond of her, and the bad news might spoil his fun.
"Oh, this is unbearable," muttered Hamidullah, for Miss Quested was back again.
"Mr. Fielding, has Ronnie told you of this new misfortune?"
He bowed.
"Ah, me."
She sat down and seemed to stiffen into a monument.
"Heslop is waiting for you, I think."
"I do so long to be alone. She was my best friend, far more to me than to him. I can't bear to be with Ronnie. I can't explain. Could you do me the very great kindness of letting me stop after all?"
Hamidullah swore violently in the vernacular.
"I should be pleased. But does Mr. Heslop wish it?"
"I didn't ask him. We are too much upset. It's so complex, not like what unhappiness is supposed to be. Each of us ought to be alone and think. Do come and see Ronnie again."
"I think he should come in this time," said Fielding, feeling that this much was due to his own dignity. "Do ask him to come."
She returned with him. He was half miserable, half arrogant, indeed a strange mix-up, and broke at once into uneven speech.
"I came to bring Miss Quested away, but her visit to the Turtons has ended, and there is no other arrangement so far. Minor bachelor quarters now."
Fielding stopped him courteously.
"Say no more. Miss Quested stops here. I only wanted to be assured of your approval. Miss Quested, you had better send for your own servant if he can be found, but I will leave orders with mine to do all they can for you. Also, I'll let the scouts know. They have guarded the college ever since it was closed, and may as well go on. I really think you'll be as safe here as anywhere. I shall be back Thursday."
Meanwhile, Hamidullah, determined to spare the enemy no incidental pain, had said to Ronnie,
"We hear, sir, that your mother has died. May we ask where the cable came from?"
"Aden."
"Ah, you were boasting she had reached Aden in court."
"But she died on leaving Bombay," broke in Adela. "She was dead when they called her name this morning. She must have been buried at sea."
Somehow this stopped Hamidullah, and he desisted from his brutality, which had shocked Fielding more than anyone else. He remained silent while the details of Miss Quested's occupation of the college were arranged, merely remarking to Ronnie,
"It is clearly to be understood, sir, that neither Mr. Fielding nor any of us are responsible for this lady's safety at Government College."
To which Ronnie agreed. After that, he watched the semi-chivalrous behavings of the three English with quiet amusement. He thought Fielding had been incredibly silly and weak, and he was amazed by the younger people's want of proper pride. When they were driving out to Dilkusha hours late, he said to Amrit Rao, who accompanied them,
"Mr. Amrit Rao, have you considered what sum Miss Quested ought to pay as compensation?"
20,000 rupees.
No more was then said, but the remark horrified Fielding. He couldn't bear to think of the queer, honest girl losing her money, and possibly her young man too. She advanced into his consciousness suddenly, and fatigued by the merciless and enormous day, he lost his usual sane view of human intercourse, and felt that we exist not in ourselves, but in terms of each other's minds, a notion for which logic offers no support, and which had attacked him only once before, the evening after the catastrophe, when from the veranda of the club he saw the fists and fingers of the Marabar swell until they included the whole night sky.
Let us now return to your English visit.
"We haven't discussed poetry for 2 seconds, said the other, smiling.
But Aziz was addicted to cameos. He held the tiny conversation in his hand and felt it epitomized his problem. For an instant, he recalled his wife, and as happens when a memory is intense, the past became the future, and he saw her with him in a quiet Hindu jungle native state, far away from foreigners. He said,
"I suppose you will visit Miss Quested?"
"If I have time. It will be strange seeing her in Hampstead."
"What is Hampstead?"
"An artistic and thoughtful little suburb of London."
"And there she lives in comfort.
You will enjoy seeing her. Dear me, I've got a headache this evening. Perhaps I am going to have cholera. With your permission, I'll leave early. When would you like the carriage? Don't trouble, I'll bike. But you haven't got your bicycle. My carriage fetched you. Let it take you away.
Sound reasoning, he said, trying to be gay. I have not got my bicycle. But I am seen too often in your carriage. I am thought to take advantage of your generosity by Mr. Ram Chand.
He was out of sorts and uneasy. The conversation jumped from topic to topic in a broken-backed fashion. They were affectionate and intimate, but nothing clicked tight.
Aziz, you have forgiven me the stupid remark I made this morning.
When you called me a little rotter?
Yes, to my eternal confusion. You know how fond I am of you.
That is nothing, of course. We all of us make mistakes. In a friendship such as ours, a few slips are of no consequence.
But as he drove off, something depressed him. A dull pain of body or mind, waiting to rise to the surface. When he reached the bungalow, he wanted to return and say something very affectionate. Instead, he gave the sais a heavy tip and sat down gloomily on the bed, and Hassan massaged him incompetently. The eye flies had colonized the top of an almirah. The red stains on the durry were thicker, for Muhammad Latif had slept here during his imprisonment and spat a good deal. The table drawer was scarred where the police had forced it open. Everything in Chandrapur was used up, including the air. The trouble rose to the surface now. He was suspicious. He suspected his friend of intending to marry Miss Quested for the sake of her money, and of going to England for that purpose.
Hazur?
For he had muttered.
Look at those flies on the ceiling. Why have you not drowned them?
Hazur, they return.
Like all evil things.
To divert the conversation, Hassan related how the kitchen boy had killed a snake, good, but killed it by cutting it in two, bad, because it becomes two snakes.
When he breaks a plate, does it become two plates?
Glasses and a new teapot will similarly be required also for myself a coat.
Aziz sighed. Each for himself. One man needs a coat, another a rich wife. Each approaches his goal by a clever detour. Fielding had saved the girl a fine of 20,000 rupees and now followed her to England. If he desired to marry her, all was explained. She would bring him a large dowry. Aziz did not believe his own suspicions. Better if he had, for then he would have denounced and cleared the situation up. Suspicion and belief could in his mind exist side by side. They sprang from different sources and need never intermingle. Above stood the secular power of Mao, elephants, artillery, crowds, and high above them a wild tempest started, confined at first to the upper regions of the air. Gusts of wind mixed darkness and light, sheets of rain cut from the north, stopped, cut from the south, began rising from below, and across them struggled the singers, sounding every note but terror, and preparing to throw God away, God himself, not that God can be thrown, into the storm. Thus was he thrown, year after year, and were others thrown, little images of Ganpati, baskets of 10-day corn, tiny taziyas after Muharram, scapegoats, husks, emblems of passage. A passage not easy, not now, not here, not to be apprehended except when it is unattainable. The god to be thrown was an emblem of that. The village of Gokul reappeared upon its tray. It was the substitute for the silver image, which never left its haze of flowers. On behalf of another symbol, it was to perish. A servitor took it in his hand and tore off the blue and white streamers. He was naked, broad-shouldered, thin-waisted, the Indian body again triumphant, and it was his hereditary office to close the gates of salvation. He entered the dark waters, pushing the village before him, until the clay dolls slipped off their chairs and began to gutter in the rain, and King Kansa was confounded with the father and mother of the Lord. Dark and solid, the little waves sipped, then a great wave washed, and then English voices cried, "Take care!"
The boats had collided with each other. The four outsiders flung out their arms and grappled, and with oars and poles sticking out, revolved like a mythical monster in the whirlwind. The worshippers howled with wrath or joy as they drifted forward helplessly against the servitor, who awaited them, his beautiful dark face expressionless, and as the last morsels melted on his tray, it struck them. The shock was minute, but Stella, nearest to it, shrank into her husband's arms, then reached forward, then flung herself against Aziz, and her motions capsized them. They plunged into the warm, shallow water and rose, struggling into a tornado of noise. The oars, the sacred tray, the letters of Ronnie and Adela broke loose and floated confusedly. Artillery was fired, drums beaten, the elephants trumpeted, and drowning all, an immense peal of thunder, unaccompanied by lightning, cracked like a mallet on the dome. That was the climax, as far as India admits of one. The rain settled in steadily to its job of wetting everybody and everything through, and soon spoilt the cloth of gold on the palanquin and the costly disc-shaped banners. Some of the torches went out, fireworks didn't catch, there began to be less singing, and the tray returned to Professor Godbully, who picked up a fragment of the martyred hearing and smeared it on his forehead without much ceremony. Whatever had happened, and while the intruders picked themselves up, the crowds of Hindus began a desultory move back into the town. The image went back too, and on the following day underwent a private death of its own, when some curtains of magenta and green were lowered in front of the dynastic shrine. The singing went on even longer, ragged edges of religion, unsatisfactory and undramatic tangles. God see love. Looking back at the great blur of the last 24 hours, no man could say where was the emotional centre of it, any more than he could locate the heart of a cloud. This opinion carried great weight. The Nawab Bahadur was a big proprietor and a philanthropist, a man of benevolence and decision. His character among all the communities in the province stood high. He was a straightforward enemy and a staunch friend, and his hospitality was proverbial.
"Give, do not leave. After death, who will thank you?" was his favourite remark.
He held it a disgrace to die rich. When such a man was prepared to motor 25 miles to shake the collector's hand, the entertainment took another aspect. For he was not like some eminent men who give out that they will come and then fail at the last moment, leaving the small fry floundering. If he said he would come, he would come. He would never deceive his supporters. The gentlemen whom he had lectured now urged one another to attend the party, although convinced at heart that his advice was unsound. He had spoken in the little room near the courts where the pleaders waited for clients. Clients waiting for pleaders sat in the dust outside. These had not received a card from Mr. Turton. And there were circles even beyond these. People who wore nothing but a loincloth, people who wore not even that, and spent their lives in knocking two sticks together before a scarlet doll. Humanity grading and drifting beyond the educated vision, until no earthly invitation can embrace it. All invitations must proceed from heaven, perhaps. Perhaps it is futile for men to initiate their own unity. They do but widen the gulfs between them by the attempt. So at all events thought old Mr. Graysford and young Mr. Sawley, the devoted missionaries who lived out beyond the slaughterhouses, always travelled third on the railways and never came up to the club. In our Father's house are many mansions, they taught, and there alone will the incompatible multitudes of mankind be welcomed and soothed. Not one shall be turned away by the servants on that veranda, be he black or white. Not one shall be kept standing who approaches with a loving heart. And why should the divine hospitality cease here? Consider, with all reverence, the monkeys. May there not be a mansion for the monkeys also? Old Mr. Graysford said no, but young Mr. Sawley, who was advanced, said yes. He saw no reason why monkeys should not have their collateral share of bliss,
and he had sympathetic discussions about them with his Hindu friends. And the jackals? Jackals were indeed less to Mr. Sawley's mind, but he admitted that the mercy of God, being infinite, may well embrace all mammals. And the wasps? He became uneasy during the descent to wasps, and was apt to change the conversation. And oranges, cactuses, crystals, and mud? And the bacteria inside Mr. Sawley? No, no, this is going too far. We must exclude someone from our gathering, or we shall be left with nothing. He was now much excited, chattering away hard, and even saying damn when he got mixed up in his sentences. He told them of his profession, and of the operations he had witnessed and performed, and he went into details that scared Mrs. Moore, though Miss Quested mistook them for proofs of his broad-mindedness. She had heard such talk at home in advanced academic circles, deliberately free. She supposed him to be emancipated as well as reliable, and placed him on a pinnacle which he could not retain. He was high enough for the moment, to be sure, but not on any pinnacle. Wings bore him up, and flagging would deposit him. The arrival of Professor Godbole quieted him somewhat, but it remained his afternoon. The Brahmin, polite and enigmatic, did not impede his eloquence, and even applauded it. He took his tea at a little distance from the outcasts, from a low table placed slightly behind him, to which he stretched back, and, as it were, encountered food by accident. All feigned indifference to Professor Godbole's tea. He was elderly and wizen, with a grey moustache and grey-blue eyes, and his complexion was as fair as a European's. He wore a turban that looked like pale purple macaroni, coat, waistcoat, dhoti, socks with clocks. The clocks matched the turban, and his whole appearance suggested harmony, as if he had reconciled the products of East and West, mental as well as physical, and could never be discomposed. The ladies were interested in him, and hoped that he would supplement Dr. Aziz by saying something about religion. But he only ate, ate and ate, smiling, never letting his eyes catch sight of his hand. Leaving the Mughal emperors, Aziz turned to topics that could distress no one. He described the ripening of the mangoes, and how, in his boyhood, he used to run out in the rains to a big mango grove belonging to an uncle and gorge there. Then, back with water streaming over you, and perhaps rather a pain inside. But I did not mind. All my friends were paining with me. We have a proverb in Urdu, "What does unhappiness matter when we are all unhappy together?" Which comes in conveniently after mangoes. Miss Quested, do wait for mangoes. Why not settle altogether in India? I'm afraid I can't do that, said Adela. She made the remark without thinking what it meant. To her, as to the three men, it seemed in key with the rest of the conversation. And not for several minutes, indeed, not for half an hour, did she realize that it was an important remark, and ought to have been made in the first place to Ronnie. Visitors like you are too rare.
They are, indeed, said Professor Godbole. Such affability is seldom seen. But what can we offer to detain them?
Mangoes, mangoes.
They laughed.
Even mangoes can be got in England now, put in Fielding. They ship them in ice-cold rooms. You can make India in England, apparently, just as you can make England in India.
Frightfully expensive in both cases, said the girl.
I suppose so.
And nasty.
But the host wouldn't allow the conversation to take this heavy turn. He turned to the old lady, who looked flustered and put out, he could not imagine why, and asked about her own plans. She replied that she should like to see over the college. Everyone immediately rose, with the exception of Professor Godbole, who was finishing a banana.
Don't you come too, Adela. You dislike institutions.
Yes, that is so,
said Miss Quested, and sat down again. Aziz hesitated. His audience was splitting up. The more familiar half was going, but the more attentive remained. Reflecting that it was an unconventional afternoon, he stopped. talk went on as before. Of the company, only Hamidullah had any comprehension of poetry. The minds of the others were inferior and rough. Yet they listened with pleasure, because literature had not been divorced from their civilization. The police inspector, for instance, did not feel that Aziz had degraded himself by reciting, nor break into the cheery guffaw with which an Englishman averts the infection of beauty. He just sat with his mind empty, and when his thoughts, which were mainly ignoble, flowed back into it, they had a pleasant freshness. The poem had done no good to anyone, but it was a passing reminder, a breath from the divine lips of beauty, a nightingale between two worlds of dust. Less explicit than the call to Krishna, it voiced our loneliness nevertheless, our isolation, our need for the friend who never comes, yet is not entirely disproved. Aziz it left thinking about women again, but in a different way, less definite, more intense. Sometimes poetry had this effect on him. Sometimes it only increased his local desires, and he never knew beforehand which effect would ensue. He could discover no rule for this or for anything else in life. Hamidullah had called in on his way to a worrying committee of notables, nationalist in tendency, where Hindus, Muslims, two Sikhs, two Parsis, a Jain and a native Christian tried to like one another more than came natural to them. As long as someone abused the English, all went well. But nothing constructive had been achieved, and if the English were to leave India, the committee would vanish also. He was glad that Aziz, whom he loved and whose family were connected with his own, took no interest in politics, which ruined the character and career. Yet nothing can be achieved without them. He thought of Cambridge, sadly, as of another poem that had ended. How happy he had been there 20 years ago. Politics had not mattered in Mr. and Mrs. Bannister's rectory. There, games, work, and pleasant society had interwoven and appeared to be sufficient substructure for a national life. Here, all was wire-pulling and fear. Messrs. Syed Mohammed and Haq, he couldn't even trust them, although they had come in his carriage, and the schoolboy was a scorpion. Bending down, he said,
"Aziz, Aziz, my dear boy, we must be going. We are already late. Get well quickly, for I do not know what our little circle would do without you."
"I shall not forget those affectionate words," replied Aziz. "Add mine to them," said the engineer. "Thank you, Mr. Syed Mohammed, I will." "And mine."
"And, sir, accept mine," cried the others,
stirred each according to his capacity towards goodwill. Little, ineffectual, unquenchable flames. The company continued to sit on the bed and to chew sugar cane, which Hassan had run for into the bazaar, and Aziz drank a cup of spiced milk. Presently there was the sound of another carriage. Dr. Panalal had arrived, driven by horrid Mr. Ramchand. The atmosphere of a sick room was at once re-established, and the invalid retired under his quilt.
"Gentlemen, you will excuse, I have come to inquire by Major Callender's orders," said the Hindu, nervous of the den of fanatics into which his curiosity had called him.
"Here he lies," said Hamidullah, indicating the prostrate form.
Dr. Aziz, I come to inquire."
Having wandered off into the plain for a mile, the train slowed up against an elephant. There was a platform, too, but it shriveled into insignificance. An elephant waving her painted forehead at the morn.
"Oh, what a surprise,"
called the ladies politely. Aziz said nothing, but he nearly burst with pride and relief. The elephant was the one grand feature of the picnic, and God alone knew what he had gone through to obtain her. Semi-official, she was best approached through the Nawab Bahadur, who was best approached through Nuruddin, but he never answered letters. But his mother had great influence with him and was a friend of Hamidullah Begum's, who had been excessively kind and had promised to call on her provided the broken shutter of the Purda carriage came back soon enough from Calcutta. That an elephant should depend from so long and so slender a string filled his ears with content, and with humorous appreciation of the East, where the friends of friends are a reality, where everything gets done sometime, and sooner or later, everyone gets his share of happiness. And Muhammad Latif was likewise content, because two of the guests had missed the train, and consequently he could ride on the howdah instead of following in a cart, and the servants were content because an elephant increased their self-esteem, and they tumbled out the luggage into the dust with shouts and bangs, issuing orders to one another and convulsed with goodwill. "It takes an hour to get there, an hour to get back, and 2 hours for the caves, which we will call 3, said Aziz, smiling charmingly. There was suddenly something regal about him. "The train back is at 11:30, and you will be sitting down to your tiffin in Chandrapur with Mr. Heslop at exactly your usual hour, namely 1:15. I know everything about you. 4 hours, quite a small expedition, and an hour extra for misfortunes, which occur somewhat frequently among my people. My idea is to plan everything without consulting you. But you, Mrs. Moore, or Miss Quested, you are at any moment to make alterations if you wish, even if it means giving up the caves. Do you agree? Then mount this wild animal." The elephant had knelt, grey and isolated, like another hill. They climbed up the ladder, and he mounted shikar fashion, treading first on the sharp edge of the heel and then into the looped-up tail. When Muhammad Latif followed him, the servant who held the end of the tail let go of it according to previous instructions, so that the poor relative slipped and had to cling to the netting over the buttocks. It was a little piece of court buffoonery, and distressed only the ladies whom it was intended to divert. Both of them disliked practical jokes. Then the beast rose in 2 shattering movements and poised them 10 feet above the plain. Immediately below was the scurf of life that an elephant always collects round its feet. Villagers, naked babies. The servants flung crockery into tongas. Hassan annexed the stallion intended for Aziz and defied Mahmud Ali's man from its altitude. The Brahmin who had been hired to cook for Professor Godbole was planted under an acacia tree to await their return. The train, also hoping to return, wobbled away through the fields, turning its head this way and that like a centipede. And the only other movement to be seen was a movement as of antennae, really the counterpoises of the wells which rose and fell on their pivots of mud all over the plain and dispensed a feeble flow of water. The scene was agreeable, rather than not, in the mild morning air, but there was little colour in it, and no vitality. As the elephant moved towards the hills, the pale sun had by this time saluted them to the base and pencilled shadows down their creases, a new quality occurred, a spiritual silence which invaded more senses than the ear. Chapter 19. Hamidullah was the next stage. He was waiting outside the superintendent's office and sprang up respectfully when he saw Fielding. To the Englishman's passionate, "It's all a mistake," he answered, Ah, has some evidence come?" "It will come," said Fielding, holding his hand.
"Ah, yes, Mr. Fielding, but when once an Indian has been arrested, we do not know where it will stop."
His manner was deferential.
"You are very good to greet me in this public fashion. I appreciate it. But, Mr. Fielding, nothing convinces a magistrate except evidence. Did Mr. McBride make any remark when my card came in? Do you think my application annoyed him? Will prejudice him against my friend at all? If so, I will gladly retire."
"He is not annoyed, and if he was, what does it matter?"
"Ah, it's all very well for you to speak like that, but we have to live in this country."
The leading barrister of Chandrapur, with the dignified manner and Cambridge degree, had been rattled. He too loved Aziz, and knew he was calumniated, but faith did not rule his heart, and he prated of policy and evidence in a way that saddened the Englishman. Fielding too had his anxieties. He didn't like the field glasses or the discrepancy over the guide, but he relegated them to the edge of his mind and forbade them to infect its core. Aziz was innocent, and all action must be based on that, and the people who said he was guilty were wrong, and it was hopeless to try to propitiate them.
At the moment when he was throwing in his lot with Indians, he realized the profundity of the gulf that divided him from them. They always do something disappointing. Aziz had tried to run away from the police, Muhammad Latif had not checked the pilfering, and now Hamidullah. Instead of raging and denouncing, he temporized. Are Indians cowards? No. But they are bad starters, and occasionally jib. Fear is everywhere. The British Raj rests on it. The respect and courtesy Fielding himself enjoyed were unconscious acts of propitiation. He told Hamidullah to cheer up, all would end well. And Hamidullah did cheer up, and became pugnacious and sensible. McBride's remark, "If you leave the line, you leave a gap in the line," was being illustrated. First and foremost, the question of bail. Application must be made this afternoon. Fielding wanted to stand surety. Hamidullah thought the Nawab Bahadur should be approached. Why drag him in, though? To drag in everyone was precisely the barrister's aim. He then suggested that the lawyer in charge of the case should be a Hindu. The defence would then make a wider appeal. Chapter 24. Making sudden changes of gear, the heat accelerated its advance after Mrs. Moore's departure, until existence had to be endured and crime punished with the thermometer at 112. Electric fans hummed and spat, water splashed onto screens, ice clinked, and outside these defences, between a greyish sky and a yellowish earth, clouds of dust moved hesitatingly. In Europe, life retreats out of the cold, and exquisite fireside myths have resulted. Balder, Persephone. But here the retreat is from the source of life, the treacherous sun, and no poetry adorns it, because disillusionment cannot be beautiful. Men yearn for poetry, though they may not confess it. They desire that joy shall be graceful, and sorrow august, and infinity have a form, and India fails to accommodate them. The annual helter-skelter of April, when irritability and lust spread like a canker, is one of her comments on the orderly hopes of humanity. Fish manage better. Fish, as the tanks dry, wriggle into the mud and wait for the rains to uncake them. But men try to be harmonious all the year round, and the results are occasionally disastrous. The triumphant machine of civilization may suddenly hitch and be immobilized into a car of stone, and at such moments the destiny of the English seems to resemble their predecessors, who also entered the country with intent to refashion it, but were in the end worked into its pattern and covered with its dust. Adela, after years of intellectualism, had resumed her morning kneel to Christianity. There seemed no harm in it. It was the shortest and easiest cut to the unseen, and she could tack her troubles onto it. Just as the Hindu clerks asked Lakshmi for an increase in pay, so did she implore Jehovah for a favourable verdict. God, who saves the king, will surely support the police. Her deity returned a consoling reply, but the touch of her hands on her face started prickly heat, and she seemed to swallow and expectorate the same insipid clot of air that had weighed on her lungs all the night. Also the voice of Mrs. Turton disturbed her.
"Are you ready, young lady?"
It pealed from the next room.
"Half a minute,"
she murmured. The Turtons had received her after Mrs. Moore left. Their kindness was incredible, but it was her position, not her character, that moved them.
Chapter 27. "Aziz, are you awake?"
"No, so let us have a talk. Let us dream plans for the future."
"I am useless at dreaming." "Good night then, dear fellow." The victory banquet was over, and the revellers lay on the roof of plain Mr. Zulfikar's mansion, asleep, or gazing through mosquito nets at the stars. Exactly above their heads hung the constellation of the Lion, the disk of Regulus so large and bright that it resembled a tunnel, and when this fancy was accepted, all the other stars seemed tunnels too.
Are you content with our day's work, Cyril? The voice on his left continued. Are you? Except that I ate too much. How is stomach? How head? I say, Panalal and Kalender will get the sack.
There'll be a general move at Chandrapur,
and you'll get promotion.
They can't well move me down, whatever their feelings.
In any case, we spend our holidays together and visit Kashmir, possibly Persia, for I shall have plenty of money paid to me on account of the injury sustained by my character, he explained with cynical calm. While with me, you shall never spend a single pie. This is what I have always wished, and as the result of my misfortunes, it has come.
You have won a great victory, began Fielding.
I know, my dear chap, I know. Your voice need not become so solemn and anxious. I know what you are going to say next. Let Miss Quested off paying, so that the English may say, here is a native who has actually behaved like a gentleman. If it was not for his black face, we would almost allow him to join our club. The approval of your compatriots no longer interests me. I have become anti-British, and ought to have done so sooner. It would have saved me numerous misfortunes.
Including knowing me.
I say, shall we go and pour water onto Muhammad Latif's face? He is so funny when this is done to him asleep.
The remark was not a question, but a full stop. Fielding accepted it as such, and there was a pause, pleasantly filled by a little wind which managed to brush the top of the house. The banquet, though riotous, had been agreeable, and now the blessings of leisure unknown to the West, which either works or idles, descended on the motley company. Civilization strays about like a ghost here, revisiting the ruins of empire, and is to be found not in great works of art or mighty deeds, but in the gestures well-bred Indians make when they sit or lie down. Fielding, who had dressed up in a native costume, learnt from his excessive awkwardness in it that all his motions were makeshifts, whereas when the Nawab Bahadur stretched out his hand for food, or Nuruddin applauded a song, something beautiful had been accomplished which needed no development. This restfulness of gesture, it is the peace that passeth understanding, after all, it is the social equivalent of yoga. Suspicion in the Oriental is a sort of malignant tumour, a mental malady that makes him self-conscious and unfriendly suddenly. He trusts and mistrusts at the same time in a way the Westerner cannot comprehend. It is his demon, as the Westerner's is hypocrisy. Aziz was seized by it, and his fancy built a satanic castle, of which the foundation had been laid when Fielding and he talked at Dilkusha under the stars. The girl had surely been Cyril's mistress when she stopped in the college. Muhammad Latif was right. But was that all? Perhaps it was Cyril who followed her into the cave. No, impossible. Cyril hadn't been on the Kawadol at all. Impossible. Ridiculous. Yet the fancy left him trembling with misery. Such treachery, if true, would have been the worst in Indian history. Nothing so vile, not even the murder of Afzal Khan by Shivaji. He was shaken as though by a truth, and told Hassan to leave him. Next day, he decided to take his children back to Mussoorie. They had come down for the trial that he might bid them farewell, and had stayed on at Hamidullah's for the rejoicings. Major Roberts would give him leave, and during his absence Fielding would go off to England. The idea suited both his beliefs and his suspicions. Events would prove which was right, and preserve in either case his dignity. Fielding was conscious of something hostile, and because he was really fond of Aziz, his optimism failed him. Travelling light is less easy as soon as affection is involved. Unable to jog forward in the serene hope that all would come right, he wrote an elaborate letter in the rather modern style. It is on my mind that you think me a prude about women. I had rather you thought anything else of me. If I live impeccably now, it is only because I am well on in the 40s, a period of revision. In the 80s I shall revise again, and before the 90s come, I shall be revised. But, alive or dead, I am absolutely devoid of morals. Do kindly grasp this about me. Aziz did not care for the letter at all. It hurt his delicacy. He liked confidences, however gross, but generalizations and comparisons always repelled him. Life is not a scientific manual. He replied coldly, regretting his inability to return from Mussoorie before his friend.